Well, welcome to this week's episode of For What It's Worth. I'm your host, Blake Melnick, and this is part two of my interview with Tom Locke, author of a fantastic new book called Moments in Time, an interactive musical odyssey that traces the history of rock and roll from the 40s right through to the end of the 70s. In our last episode, Tom discussed his career, his early influences, and what inspired his love of music. In this episode, the focus of our discussion is on the book itself, what led Tom to finally write and publish Moments in Time, and Tom shares some stories about his journey and the people he met along the way. He also provides some sage advice to those who have ever entertained the idea of publishing their own book, For What It's Worth. Yeah, I read that in your book that you struggled to find a radio station that was willing to include Moments in Time in their regular scheduled programming. And I guess that's really just the nature of the industry, that radio shows have design formats and what you were doing just didn't fit with their programming.
Everything's about timing. For example, back in the 60s, in 61, 37 hours of primetime television were Westerns. Hence, that's why when The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance came out, now recognized as one of the great movies of all time in terms of Westerns, it bombed.
Yeah, it did.
So timing is always a big issue. Today, as we've got more and more advanced and people looking at things, our attention span has shrunk. So if you can't get somebody, say, in the first page or two that you've written, be it a script or an idea or a concept or a business approach, you're not going to get them. So learning to write succinctly and at the same time being able to grab them is key and still have meat in it, right? So that was the impetus behind me revisiting this when online internet radio came of age in the late 90s.
You chronicle this in the book, and you eventually did manage to find a radio station in Vancouver and a host who agreed to include Moments in Time in their show. So what was the name of the show, the DJ, and how were you able to persuade them?
Again, it gets back to the power of relationships. And so this happened with an internet radio show in the year 2000. In 1997, my good friend Michael Godin, who used to be head of artist and repertoire for A&M Records. He came out here in the mid-80s, summertime, and I did to represent Paul Janz. He was also the guy that discovered Bryan Adams. He was sitting around his kitchen table one day, invited me over for a coffee, and he says, you know what, I think internet radio is going to go someplace. I've come up with this idea of playing oldies, and it's called Treasure Island Oldies. I love the name, and he had Martin Denning's Quiet Jungle as the opening, which is very cool. Like I could see you being on a desert island, so it helped create a visual for me. I said, hey, Michael, I think this is a great idea, and I started listening to the show, and we've always been pretty close from my days when I used to work for Ampex. So what happens is, in 2000, my friend in the film entertainment business, a guy gets a crazy idea that he is going to promote this new peanut butter. He had a fascination for peanut butter. I know this sounds a little wild. And he said, you know, Tom, I think it's going to knock Skippy off the map, was his comment. He's the best, so he didn't know about, you know, peanut butter in Canada. And I said, well, that sounds great, Herb. I said, let me think about it. Maybe I can come up with some ideas for marketing. It hit me. I started thinking about Paul Harvey's show, and he didn't have that commercial break, which was for True Value Hardware. That's how strong I remember Paul Harvey's spot. I remember the commercial for Pete's sakes. Mm. So I go to Michael, and I said, I got an idea. I said, what if we could create Paul Harvey-type five-minute segment for your show, make your internet different than others? We'll have this weekly segment on the show where we'll tell a story, we'll play this commercial from this peanut butter that's being promoted in the U.S. We had the jingles, we had everything, and then we'll come back at the end of the story and you can play the record. What do you think? He says, I'd love to try it. So I had the commercial with me to bring to the show for free in order to make it happen. So that's what we did. So we ended up creating, this guy's name was Sorrels Pickards. Like, that's the original guy that my friend Herb tied into. He was out of Florida. He grew up on a peanut farm. That's his real name. He's a Nashville singer-songwriter. In fact, the epilogue in my book is about this gentleman. So we came up with the Soros Pickers Peanut Butter Pick of the Week, which Michael goes, oh, geez, I got to say that every week.
Right.
So we did it, and we did it for 2 or 3 years. We even had Soros on the show. We brought him in on internet radio. People loved it. And he suddenly passed away. And that was the end of the peanut butter and the peanut butter company. And so now Michael's left with a spot not really being liked by his listeners. And so I said, let's change it. So let's call it Moments in Time. And that's how it evolved thereafter from the year about 2003 onward.
Mm. What was the reaction when Moments in Time was first introduced on the air? Did you get any kind of feedback from the audience,
well,
from the listeners?
Michael came back to me and said, Tom, when I started playing this, my chat room lights up every time this comes on with their reaction to the song and the stories. And if I read I Didn't Know That one more time, I won't be amazed. And which was a very interesting comment. And then I would go into the chat room, and I met some of the people in the chat room. And he has quite a large chat room. It's kind of interesting. And these people really do know their music. Some of them, by the way, are DJs from other stations throughout the U.S. and from Michael's syndicated network for his show. And they're going, geez, I didn't know that. I didn't know that. So I've had that reaction, gosh, let's say for 15 years anyway.
So you had this success then on the radio. And what made you want to write the book? I mean, is there any difference between the book and the radio segments?
It's a great question, but it gets back down to what we talked about before, that physical presence in front of you. Here I have them all sitting nicely in my computer. Do I ever go, no, look at them? No. And does anybody else, if you're harking back, if they're taping the show or go back and look at them? I doubt it. Hey, why not have that in a book? And I didn't come up with the idea about the book. It was actually driven by my friends and Michael's listeners on the show. I said, Tom, you should have this in a book. I'd love to have this. And then some of the DJs that I interacted with over the years, and most recently they're going, hey, this is a music reference book for us. These are great tidbits that we can use without rambling on about some artists. There's a hook in each of the stories. So that's what motivated me. Then obviously the next thing was finding the time to write it.
Right.
And COVID came along. You know, sometimes procrastination becomes a winner. The winning part was all these changes in technology. I've always kept up to speed with technology. That's always been fascinating for me, certainly in my business of post-production. So all of a sudden, my goal was, hey, this book's great. How can I make it interactive somehow? That was my initial words, interactive. So I can create instant gratification. Can that person hear the song? And that's where the QR codes evolved. So you could link to the song. So the guy reads it, gets all excited. Oh, yeah, I remember this song. Jeez, I love to hear it. So instead of jumping off, going on the computer, doing it, or maybe in some cases they go, hey, Alexa, play this song, so they could get instant gratification. It's right there, and it's right in the book. It's self-contained. So that timing was great. And also because of COVID, given my age group, people understood what QR codes was because they had to have it for their vaccination.
Right, of course. Mm-hmm. For our listeners, and this is one of the most fascinating things about this book, the inclusion of the QR codes at the end of each moment in time allows you to listen to the song, and it changes the whole experience. It's almost a multimedia experience, uniting the old reading and writing and the new, which is the technology. And I thought that was so brilliant. So I love being able to read the history, read the moment, and then listen to the song. And I found myself actually going back to the songs after I'd finished the book and listening to them again, and then going through my old record collection going, I have a version of that song. It was a fascinating experience, really engaging. That's one of the things I love the most about the book. But let's talk about the structure a bit more. How many moments of time are in the book?
Let's break it down. There's 12 chapters. Each chapter has 10 moments in time. So it's 120. And then there's one at the end when I do the epilogue on Soros Pickers, we talked about with his moment in time that we wrote when he does, ironically, Goodnight Irene, and singing it with Waylon Jennings, Billy Swan, and Kris Kristofferson, his buddies. Soros is an amazing guy. Five of his records are on Beaucoup de Blues album, Ringo Starr's album. So I had to pay tribute to him. So there's 121 in total.
How did you decide what your end songs to include? I'm assuming that you had more than 120 moments in time to choose from.
Did I ever? It takes 20 years of writing, approximately 50 per year. So that's 1,000 pieces. And I think the big thing to me, the sensitivity, and I mentioned this very importantly, the book is not about me, but the music we grew up with. So it's not a particular song that maybe to me, it's a song that I know will resonate with the people. So that was first and foremost in my mind and going through that. I even try to do that every week when I write them anyway, or there's some hook that'll make a song they may have never thought of, like you talked about before. Ooh, now I get, hey, that's pretty cool. So that was the driver for me. I also believed there was two audiences. There's certainly the people I grew up with, but there is the sons and daughters of that audience who would reflect on, so, oh yeah, my parents. Yeah, that's what they grew up at. Isn't that interesting? Or they would might say, I didn't know that was the original. I know it by such and such, you know, because a lot of great records get redone. There's cover versions spanning 40, 50, 60 years. A good song will always survive. So I kept that in my mind when I started breaking down. Even so, I got down to about 250 going, yikes, this is going to be painful. Well, let's see how many aha moments are in each of these pieces I'm writing. And so gradually, painstakingly, this is the hardest part, by the way, was breaking that down to come up with the first 120.
Yeah, I bet. So talk a little bit about how you've chunked the material in the book, because I found that also quite fascinating.
The beauty of the book, and I learned this from a number of business books that I'd read in the past. I didn't want the book to be linear. Now you start at page one, you got to go right to the end. I wanted it designed such that you could pick up the book, you could open it up anywhere, you could read the two-page story on the song, and all the stories are only two pages, by the way. Go down to the QR code, click it on, and you had that moment in time for yourself. So then I got to the point, they talk about, okay, good, well, what should we embrace? So here's the songs I picked. Now let's go back. Let's see if there's a theme within these top 10. For example, I'm going, that's a UK one. That's an English one. That's an English one. That's an English one. From across the pond. So that's how I created that chapter. And then I would go through the early roots of rock and roll. And so there's a whole bunch of interesting groups there. Obviously late 40s, early 50s oriented, but geez, hey, I had 10 of those. Boom, let's do that. Dynamic groups was easy to figure out because a lot of the bands and groups, and they were dynamic. So that was easy to figure out, that chapter. And then I had two chapters at the end. One was called I Didn't Know That. This was very cool because I know these were all real ha-ha moments, so created that chapter. And then I had one at the end. I had one just for fun, which was just about novelty records.
Right.
And I had a number of novelty records that made me laugh. Everybody loved novelty records. Novelty records would shoot right to the top of the chart, and they'd sink just as fast the next day for the most part, or come out every year. So I thought, hey, let's have some fun with that. So those are the approach that I took with those. And it was fun doing it, outlining the book. That's part of, I think, the whole strategy in writing the book is getting a real solid outline that, A, you can work with, B, is going to be palatable to your viewer. You always got to keep the viewer, the listener, in this case, in mind.
I did love that chapter on the comedy side, the fun side of music. I mean, who doesn't remember Flying Purple People Eater or Hot Rod Lincoln was a huge one for me growing up. I love that song. And I still listen to it. Of course, Frankie Valli did a whole bunch that come to mind. But that was really fun for me to read that section in the book. So now that the book's published and out there, are there moments that didn't make the cut that you wish you had included?
Oh, yeah, that's easy. There's probably another 100. But if I had to pick two that come to mind, I didn't have anything on Jackie Wilson in there, who is one of my favorite singers of all time. And the story on his breakout record, Reed Petite, is quite interesting. In fact, the first six of Jackie Wilson's records were actually written by Berry Gordy Jr. It's a great story, and the Repeat Heat one would be a big one. It didn't chart that great when it first came out. Now it's recognized as one of the great songs in rock and roll.
Right.
It was early days. And the other one that comes to mind, and I think I'm going to resolve that with my next book, is I didn't put something in about the Beaumarks, you know, out of Montreal, Canada's Clap Your Hands is a great story and how it came to be, and definitely should make it. So I think I'm going to actually have a Made in Canada chapter next time around.
Well, that's great. Let's talk a little bit about the publishing and promotion of the book. Did you write the book first, or did you pitch the idea before the book was written? Or was it done sort of simultaneously?
Well, it's interesting. I actually wrote the book first, and I was just going to write it like I've written other things, not publish it at all, just to put it in a PDF format, share it with friends, you know, that type of thing. That was my first thoughts. Then I was reading a friend of mine's book, and I flipped over the back of it, and I seen this logo at T, as in Tom, S, T as in Paul, A. And I said, what's that? And so I phoned him. I said, what's that? He said, well, I self-published my book, and this is the self-publishing company, and they're called the Self-Publishing Agency. And I said, an interesting angle. And he says, full marks for that. I'm glad I went that route, published my own book. He said, I wasn't out for the money. I wanted to control it myself. And I was introduced to them by my son. So I said, it's worth a phone call. I knew about publishers and stuff like that. I knew if I didn't explore this, I would be remiss. And I'm so happy I did. And kudos to the self-publishing agency for their assistance, because I learned a lot. I always believe in lifelong learning. And this was a phenomenal exercise for me, because I had a chance to go through and compare, what am I up against publishing-wise? What am I up against self-publishing-wise? And decide to go the route and with their assistance.
So why did you go that route? Well, let me step back for a second. You never went to a publishing company and pitched the idea at all? Is that correct?
No, that's correct. I went out and talked with a whole bunch of other friends with books and stuff like this from the sporting world, from the music world, and I'd probably still be talking to a publisher today. I spun this book around when I signed on with these guys, and I had this all done, and I finished off my first draft from the end of March last year, and I had it in print format by October of last year. So March 2021, October 2021, I'd still be talking to the publishing company today. I'm convinced of that. Secondly, I get to fall on my own sword. I control everything in the book. I get to choose who my designer is. I get to work with designer. I have last say on the design. I get to choose my editor. I have last say on the editing, and I get to find my printer, and I get to print accordingly and how much I want and when. So that was a big thing to me, and also the ability to go online and get through the maze of getting on Amazon, and they helped me out incredibly with doing that. Just like that whole type of approach, that I could be in control of this, because it was truly my baby.
Right. I can see why you would go that direction. I know our listeners are going to be interested in this, but what are some of the pros and cons of self-publishing? And if you were to give our listeners some advice, if they have an interest in self-publishing, what would it be?
I think first and foremost, it's a great question. I'm so glad you asked it. First and foremost, you got to answer the question to yourself truthfully, why am I writing this book? That is key. And in the why, just to get the story out because you want to tell this story, I don't care what genre it is. Do you want to make money? It's because I think this is a great idea and I want to make some money through writing. There's a target audience. Who is it? Who's going to buy this book? Who am I writing to? You got to answer those questions to a point that, hey, okay, I'm comfortable with moving forward with that. Now, if you're just a creative, you don't want to go to the art firm, nothing wrong with talking to some publishing companies and getting the lowdown. And if you're in no hurry to do so, that's fine too. You definitely should compare the alternatives. One of the things about self-publishing is, yeah, you can do it by yourself. There's a lot of things to learn to go through it and do it, but that certainly does take time. I've always been a fan of working with experts, and I certainly found this group to work with an expert. Cost you some money. We'll talk to the cons on this in a minute. But the whole point is to get you on the right path, to feel comfortable, to get you to the real players in all different facets of writing a book. If you have that confidence, that trust in the group you're working with, it makes it pleasurable in moving forward. And I'm blessed with the fact that that's what happened for me. On the con side, all expense is at the front end for you. If you're happy with that, if it's not a moneymaker, or even if it is a moneymaker, if you're happy to, you know, take on those expenses because you have control, then you should do that. But if I put on my analytical hat for a moment, what I would take a look at is this. Estimate your budget, how much you're willing to spend. Take a look at what the cost or the pricing you think your book can manage in the marketplace. Divide it up and figure out how many books you need to sell. And then determine, hey, is there an audience out there that would buy this book? And then that number to make this, in worst case, break even. Keeping in mind that writing the book, putting it all together, getting it done, getting some exposure is only 50% of the deal. You then have to spend 50% of your time afterwards marketing and promoting this. And you got to look at a good year in doing it to get the traction that your book should deserve.
It's a really all-encompassing thing. It's a full-time job is what I'm hearing.
It is. It is. So this 2022 is a full-time job for me, marketing and promoting this book. It's only worldwide on Amazon on November the 11th. It's done really well. I've got to keep the momentum going. Moreover, every place where I'm going and talking to, it's like a brand new story. Oh, I didn't know about this. Of course not. But you've got to make that approach and be patient in terms of when they have the time to talk to you, if they want to have the time to talk to you, what avenues you want to take. And don't put all your eggs in one basket and move forward. You got to look at a whole different alternatives, from free book reviews to trying to get on air. In my case, because of music, as beautiful as DJs, I can do that. So those are some of the issues you got to take. And if you can, in going forward, if you need a marketing or promotional professional, seek one out that has passion for what you're writing and get a feel if they can move it forward. And that's more than somebody putting stuff on YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. There's much more to that. There's much more than that moving down the line. I mean, a number of things I'm looking at, I'm actually creating a course on this that I could present. I could go to care facilities, for example, and present the story, the music that they grew up with, for example. You can go turn around and sit back and continue creating a weekly moment in time, which is what I do, and send it out to the followers of your book. So they know they're getting those stories, they're moving forward. But meanwhile, you're keeping your book front and center. And last but not least, the most important thing about this, do it because you want to do it. You want to have fun doing it and not because you have to.
Good point, because obviously you've dedicated a lot of time and energy to this and continue to do so. But again, it's such a fantastic book. I think you're going to be very successful with it. We're approaching the end of our interview, but I want to know what surprised you most about this whole experience of writing the book, publishing it, self-publishing. What happened that you didn't anticipate?
One thing I anticipated was I really believed I was going to get people coming back and say, hey, I'm so glad you wrote this book. Boy, does this ever resonate with me. However, I didn't realize how many of those I was going to get. So that really stood me up a bit going, boy, my timing has been very good with this. So that excited me, and all the 5-star reviews I've had on Amazon worldwide was phenomenal in terms of quantity. I'm honored with the fact that DJs in North America and music promoters in Japan and in the UK have adopted my book as a reference book for their music platforms. So I think that was a bit of a surprise. And I guess the last one is who you meet along in the way of the journey, or who you find out's really interested in music you never knew. Fellow Canadians, who would have known that Dave Hodge of Hockey Night in Canada fame had a passion for music? And we had an hour and a half conversation on music, although he's more in the current vein because he said it keeps him young, but his passion is the same. But we had a great chat for about an hour and a half one day, and we've become friends, and we're going to, you know, hook up again, and hopefully this spring when things settle down and I head back east. So that was kind of amazing. The other one was an interview I did for a U.S. network. And during the interview, he says, well, I got a couple of people I want you to talk to, Tom. And he brought them in during the interview. And there are people that I had talked about in the books who are still around today and verified the stories and laughed and talked about the story in my book. So I got to talk to some of my heroes or legends that I've written about. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Now, who came into the radio station?
One was the youngest girl ever have a number one hit record on Billboard. She beat Brenda Lee by a few months, and that was Little Piggy March, who in 1963 had a song called I Will Follow Him. Boy, you talk about a gal that's still got up and going. She was mad about COVID because it was cutting down her touring dates. She's 80 years old, for Pete's sake, but she's still going strong. We had a great conversation, and she says, yeah, I'm cool. I can live out of suitcases. It doesn't bother me. A really amazing gal. And I guess the other one was, there was a group you maybe remember called the Exciters. They had a record in 62 called Tell 'Em, and it was a big hit. But that has actually been recorded in history as probably one of the first music videos, because they're over in England. They ended up in Paris at a zoo, complete with polar bears, and they did the record Tell 'Em. And so I was talking to one of the backup singers, Lillian, and she was telling me the story. I didn't know what we were doing there, but we were doing it, and we had a lot of fun. But you're right, it was one of the first music videos in the industry. So those are a couple of the stories.
Yeah, and great stories, and so many great stories in the book. Now, if you decide to do a sequel, and I know you are thinking about this, what would you do differently and what would you keep the same?
I think the format would be the same. Obviously, the introduction, the preface would change a bit. I would talk to the journey to then and how the reaction has been to write book two. Definitely would be different chapters, change it up a bit. And I have a very interesting epilogue story on the most expensive 45 in the history of rock and roll that a lot of people don't know about. So I probably talked to that in there as well.
Again, I think the book is absolutely fantastic, and I wanted to let our listeners know that Tom has kindly agreed to let us include moments in time, certain moments in time from the book on the podcast, and we'll be using them, inserting them in the space in between. And I think you guys are really going to love this. It's a fabulous book. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I ate it up. It's a great read. I think you'll all want to buy copies of Tom's book. It's such an engaging experience. So we'll keep you posted on that in the show. And Tom, I want to thank you so much for all your time. We had in our pre-call, which was great to get to know you, and then, of course, during this interview. And you've been so gracious about letting us include some of your work on the show. I know our audience is going to love it. I wish you much success in your promotion of this book, and I'm going to follow you in the event that you have a sequel to the book. I do think this is very unique. I've never read a book like this that actually is interactive, that gives you the QR codes, you scan it with your cell phone, and you can listen to the music as you're reading the book. It really is a great experience. So thanks again, Tom.
You're welcome. As my brother would say in closing, he says, you got the great bathroom book. And I said, what do you mean? And he says, well, I go in, I read two pages, I click on the QR code, and I'm good to go.
Gives new meaning to singing in the shower.
There you go.
Well, thanks again, Tom. I hope we'll get you back on the show. I'm looking forward to the sequel, and I'm looking forward to playing certain segments from Moments in Time on For What It's Worth and The Space in Between.
Fantastic.
This concludes our two-part episode, Music Man, with my guest, Tom Locke. Stay tuned for another Moment in Time from Tom's book next week on The Space in Between. And join our For What It's Worth podcast series Facebook page for a little music trivia in advance of this episode, for a chance to win a signed copy of Tom's new book, Moments in Time, For What It's Worth. Our shout-out this week goes to Blair Packham and his band Impossible Dream. I had a chance to see Blair last week at Sauce on the Danforth. It was a great show. He's there every Wednesday from 7 to 9 p.m. You gotta check it out.